Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and in this edition of The Observer's high-charting film podcast, I step gingerly in front of Hannibal Lecter. Yes, the original cannibal, Brian Cox, stops by for a nice Chianti and a chat, while I catch up with the keeper of the new Hannibal flame, Peter Weber, director of the new film Hannibal Rising, joins us from his New York premiere. How red is that carpet? And have you ever wondered what they really mean when they say a film is released in a sparkling new print? Well, we talked to the head of preservation at the BFI, Andrea Callas, about Great Expectations and loving David Lean. I also review every film released this week, including Beyoncé Knowles in Dreamgirls, which seemed like a very good place to start Film Weekly. Dreamgirls, the film that's picked up the most Oscar nominations of all, with 8 nods, has still not managed one for Best Picture. Based on a Broadway musical, the film charts the rise of a girl singing group, not unlike the Supremes, who start out on a Detroit talent contest and progress to recording in an impresario's garage before becoming the biggest girl group in the world. The Dreamettes, who become the Dreamgirls, feature Beyoncé Knowles and Best Supporting Actress nominee Jennifer Hudson, while Jamie Foxx is their Berry Gordy-like Svengali, with Eddie Murphy as the soul singer who first employs the girls as his backing singers.
You don't need an amateur contest because there's nothing amateur about you. What you need is a break, and I'm here to give it to you. $30 each to sing behind Mr. Jimmy Early tonight.
Jim Earl?
And a guaranteed 10-week engagement on the road starting tomorrow morning at $400 a week.
$400? Man. You swear?
If I'm lying, I'm dying.
The omission of Dreamgirls from the Best Picture list caused some outrage back in America. Watching it, you can see why it features for costume and sound, but even the three best song nods seem a bit lucky. This is a strangely anemic musical epic that never really takes flight. Beyoncé is simply fabulous to look at. When she's dancing and singing and smiling, she's the biggest star in the world. And Jamie Foxx's character's right. When they put Beyoncé's Dina up front as the lead singer, the film gets a badly needed shot of adrenaline. The opening hour, which should be all about discovering the sound and the gritty business of starting out, feels very flat, even amateurish. Murphy's James Thunder Early character is smoothly done, but hardly sparkles. I've seen him do far better, more energetic James Brown impressions than this many times before. Much of the problem lies with the film's music, which never successfully pastiches the Motown sound of the era, and prefers instead to have its leading ladies indulge in soul diva shouting matches, until the whole thing climaxes in an orgy of screaming and grunting and soul yelling as if Serena and Venus Williams were playing doubles with Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston. Amazingly, there's no lightness or humour to Bill Condon's direction, and his film's an oddly hollow experience that never successfully engages with the social or racial issues on which it touches. Even the costumes have an imprecision about them. Eddie Murphy simply turns up in a woolly hat to indicate the Marvin Gaye What's Going On era, though I admit I did love the 5 minutes of the disco sound. So Dreamgirls falls way short of a film such as Ray, with which it bears many similarities, and it pales in capturing an era alongside a film such as Boogie Nights. In Beyoncé, it has a star, but it just doesn't make enough of her. And if I were Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, I'd be mighty annoyed that not only has someone taken my story and my life and made it into a film, but that they'd made such a pedestrian job of it. On a rather different note comes a new film from France's Luc Besson, this time trying animation for the first time in adapting French children's books Arthur et les Minimoys as Arthur and the Invisibles. Freddie Highmore, who, after Charlie in the Chocolate Factory and Finding Neverland, is rapidly establishing himself as the best child actor in the world, plays the titular Arthur, a lonely child looked after by his grandma, Mia Farrow, in a big Connecticut house under threat of repossession and demolition. Arthur can save the house if he finds the buried treasure his eccentric explorer grandpa has hidden at the bottom of the garden. Arthur's search, however, sees him transported into an animated world of weirdy little people, the Minimoys, who help him find the way to the treasure.
This is a matter of extreme urgency. In just 2 days' time, the garden will be destroyed.
What are you talking about, young man? Are you a practical joker like your grandfather?
This is no joke, Mr. Betamesh. A building contractor wants to flatten the land and build apartment blocks.
Ah! What are apartment blocks?
Enormous houses built from concrete. They will cover up all the gardens and stop the flowers from growing.
But that's awful.
The only way to prevent this is for me to find the treasure that my grandfather has hidden somewhere.
So you mean this is an emergency?
Yes, and we have to act now, because the future of your people is in your hands.
I did think I was going to hate this film, so I'll admit to being pleasantly surprised by its overall jolliness. Highmore is a real actor, capable of raw emotion, anger, determination, fear and tears, and he's much of the reason this silly story succeeds. Even when playing his animated self, his voice is distinctive and expressive. There's fun too in the other voices, which include that irritating US comic Jimmy Fallon, Madonna doing her spoilt brat act as a princess, and Robert De Niro, for no reason I could discern at all. The keen-eared will also spot Snoop Dogg and Harvey Keitel. Interestingly, this being a Besson movie, the animated princess is a real hot pixie, with an athletic bod, a cute butt, and a resemblance to Mila Jovovich. Although it's a derivative mix of the recent Flushed Away and Ants, as well as Jamie and the Magic Torch, I ended up enjoying the somewhat Gallic carelessness that's gone into this, a refreshing change from the overproduced, overhyped, overjoked and overhere American animations of recent times. Brian Cox was a hugely successful stage and television actor here throughout the 1970s and 80s. Spells at the National and RSC were coupled with Plays for Today and the odd BBC costume drama, until in 1986 he was cast almost out of nowhere as a serial killer called Hannibal Lecter in Michael Mann's Manhunter. This week, Cox can be found in Running with Scissors, playing an eccentric psychiatrist in the 70s-set memoirs of writer Augustine Burroughs, treating Annette Bening and heading up a mad family, including daughters Gwyneth Paltrow and even Rachel Wood. Film Weekly managed to catch up with the hard-working, ever-travelling Brian Cox last week, and we asked him what, apart from Very Dangerous, is Running with Scissors.
It's a memoir by Augustine Burroughs, and it's about his life and how his father and mother divorced. His mother was kind of a troubled creature, and he ended up being adopted by this psychiatrist who was actually his mother's doctor. And the less you do with the part, the better, because it the part speaks for itself. If you start to over-embellish it, it won't work. The thing about Finch is it's for the audience to make up their mind about him rather than you to kind of point them in any particular direction.
Because he is quite an over-the-top character.
He's very eccentric. You know, he dresses eccentrically, and when you think that the 70s was probably the most eccentric sartorial time ever, it's kind of double whammy that you have there.
What were you wearing in the 70s, Brian?
Oh, sort of drawbridge trousers, perms.
You had a perm?
Yeah, I had a perm at one point. Very briefly, I had a perm. Flares, which were horrible. Hipster flares. I mean, it was the worst time ever. And those tight little kind of tops. I mean, it was just ghastly. It was horrible.
Luckily, we're not a visual medium because they can't see the pictures, but I'd love to see them.
It was quite horrific. And, of course, the 70s is a very contentious time anyway, because it is a time of experimentation when ideas were being played with, where people didn't quite know what they were doing. There was a lot of suck it and see. And particularly in psychiatry, which was a fairly young kind of, it's still in its infancy. If you think about it, you know, Freud did all that amazing work before the First World War with Jung, you know, Jung on one side, Freud on the other. Then it was interrupted by a war. Then it never really gathered a little bit of pace, and then a second war came along. And then it was only really in the 50s and then really in the 60s that it got going. And the 70s was the time of people like R.D. Lang and all these kind of extraordinary experimenters, Timothy O'Leary, all psychedelic drugs, people dealing with consciousness and the realms of consciousness. We were at a crossroads, and Augustine's life is very much marked by that time.
Hmm. With particular reference to the treatment his mother was given.
That's right, exactly. And Finch was the same. He, you know, Valium, for instance, which was the opiate of the people for quite a long time. And I knew people in the 70s who were, you know, swore by Valium. I remember there was one director who had his 40th birthday, and one of the cards that we gave him was full of all the little pills that he took, you know, for his various phobias that he had, all of which were completely invented by him.
Now, Brian, you got rid of your your perm, thankfully, to play Hannibal Lecter, which I'm quite pleased that you did. I don't think you'd have got the part if you'd kept it.
No, it was definitely not a perm role.
But that's amazing. Next week, Hannibal Rising comes out, the new Hannibal. It keeps going on, this character.
Franchise. De Laurentiis has got a franchise. He's not going to let it go. I mean, Hannibal the Embryo will be the next thing that comes along. I mean, it's so odd the way this whole thing has come. And it's so odd about Tom, too. Tom Harris has become obsessed with this brilliant minor character. And, you know, I mean, I think Silence of the Lambs is a truly great book. But I think Red Dragon is a fantastic book. And just because it's all embryonic, nothing is kind of declared. Hannibal is a mysterious character. You don't know who he is or what he is. But now we know exactly who he is. We know what he has for dinner. We certainly know what he has for dinner.
And friends.
Friends. And it's very odd. It's very odd because I think it's lost its edge. I think when you examine something too carefully, you kind of take it all apart and it's all there. And then you assemble it and it's not what it was that it started with. And I don't think the Hannibal Lecter of either The Silence of the Lambs or Red Dragon is the Hannibal Lecter of Hannibal. I just think they're two entirely different people. Yeah. They've become two entirely different people.
Do you get a little pang every time you see that there's a new book or there's a new actor embodying him?
No, it's always good for me because I always get great reviews. You know, so I don't worry about it. How I'll fare against Hannibal the Child, I don't know.
I think you'd have him. The Hollywood move that has come, I mean, you're working extraordinarily prolifically at the moment, Brian, it seems, since you made that decision to leave here, leave the stage and go to Hollywood. Mm. Are you still very happy with that decision?
Yeah, it's harder because I've got two little boys now. And in fact, we're back here in London for a while because I was doing a play last year. And it's difficult. It's difficult to know where to live, really.
You manage a very old-style actor's life out of a trunk, almost.
Well, exactly. But that's, to me, what the life is. It's the way we are. We're rogues and vagabonds. So actually, it was Helen Mirren was talking about it the other day. And we are rogues and vagabonds. We go where the work is. You know, I mean, look at Helen. She lives in America, but she spends most of her time working here.
Well, Brian, it's great to have you back here. You look very well and fit from being in LA, I must say, anyway. So,
you're fit.
Well. Good. Great to have you. Congratulations on Running with Scissors. Great performance.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Brian Cox there. Running with Scissors starts brightly with a fine performance from Annette Bening as a frustrated writer, but it becomes overlong and boring. First-time director Ryan Murphy, the man behind Nip Tuck on the telly, is obviously in love with the material, but he pays it way too much respect, and it becomes self-indulgent, enlivened only by some fine, if florid, performances from Cox himself, Evan Rachel Wood and Alec Baldwin. We've spoken to Brian Cox, the original Hannibal Lecter, and now we pass over to New York, exactly, where Peter Weber, the director of the new Hannibal Rising film, is just about to step down a blood-red carpet to the premiere in New York of Hannibal Rising. Peter, thanks for coming on Film Weekly.
My pleasure. I'm waiting here. The limo should be pulling up in about 10 minutes' time, so, you know, buttoning my cuffs and getting ready to go.
Well, I like a taste of glamour coming down the line from New York. I mean, obviously a big night for you with Hannibal raising the curtain in New York, but when you inherited this franchise that Dino De Laurentiis has, what did you think? Because, you know, great directors, in Michael Mann, Jonathan Demme, they've all kind of dealt with this genre. How did you think you could approach it?
To be honest, because Tom had written, it's an origin story, you know, Tom had written something that was very different to the other movies, and it was set in Europe. You know, it's going much further back in time. It starts in the Second World War on the Russian front, 1944, but then we go to Paris in the early 50s. It just felt like such a different world that I thought I'd be able to do something different with it. And so, although obviously there'd be comparisons, there's always going to be, they weren't so scary. It was more a matter of finding someone really compelling in the central role and trusting in Tom's work.
When it was first Brian Cox, who we spoke to earlier, that was a very kind of quiet Hannibal. Then Anthony Hopkins kind of added a bit of panto to it and a bit of salaciousness to it. And then it grew a bit more in the sequel to that. And then in Red Dragon, it was even more. So you obviously work quite closely with Thomas Harris, as you call him. You've obviously got on quite well with him because he wrote the screenplay from that novel, didn't he, with you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's a famous recluse. He doesn't do any interviews. He doesn't do any public appearances. So it was very interesting to kind of enter the lair of the man who'd written Hannibal Lecter. He lived in Miami, so I flew in a couple of times to spend time working with him on the script, the kind of stuff that directors have to do. So we worked quite closely together, but he was a pleasure to work with. Despite the savagery of the stuff that he writes, he's actually a very gentle, very kind, very old school kind of southern gentleman, really. You could imagine that he might play a very good judge in a 1940s courtroom drama set in the Deep South.
To Eat a Mockingbird.
Very good.
I've been working on that. Peter, I wish you the best of luck. Have a lovely premiere. Sounds very
thank
exciting.
You so much.
And kiss hands, don't eat any.
Okay, thank you kindly.
Back on the big screens this week is David Lean's 1946 production of Great Expectations. It's certainly one of the best Dickens adaptations ever, and must rank as one of the finest British films ever made. Viewers will be treated to a pristine new print of the film, and to see it in the cinema is to dive into a lost world. But what does it actually mean when a film is restored and released in a new print? How do they do it? What do they do? And indeed, why should we care? The British Film Institute is currently overseeing restorations of all David Lean's work, and, intrigued, I went down to their London headquarters to meet with Andrea Callas, Head of Preservation at the BFI, and to find out how they're polishing up their Dickens. Well, I'm down in the basement of the BFI here in central London after a screening of Great Expectations, newly restored and shining like a newly minted penny. And the woman that we have to thank for that is Andrea Callas, who's restored it as part of the BFI's ongoing programme to restore all of David Lean's work. Andrea, thank you for joining us on Film Weekly. It looks fantastic.
Oh, thanks. It's such an honor to work on Great Expectations. What a film. I mean, for me, for anybody who has a personal connection to that film, for me, I first saw it in a bad 16mm projection when I was about, 10 years old after reading the book. And it's such a special film. I really hope people see it on the big screen now that it's going to be released.
I had the pleasure to actually see it at the LFF when it mm-hmm. was released as part of the BFI's Treasures from the Archive, which they always do. Now, this seems to be one of the crown jewels of British cinema, this film, Great Expectations. From that very opening scene with the gallows on the way to the marshes where Magwitch looms. I don't think there's anything scarier or more beautiful in all of British cinema.
Lean was really interested in that, creating that really strong atmospheric look. And he actually even fired his first cinematographer, Robert Krasker, because he wasn't getting that look, that foggy, strange, eerie look that he was really trying to capture.
Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat.
No, sir, no.
Tell us your name. Quick.
Pip, sir. Sir.
Show us where you live. Point out the place.
There, sir. There.
What a lot of people don't know is when they see a new print, they say released in a new 35mm print, restored to shiny new. And we critics always say, oh, yes, it's a new print, blah, 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 here's a quick review, stick it at the bottom of all our reviews. What does it actually mean that it's been restored? How does it happen? And what has been cleaned up? Because I remember it like you, this film. It always looked fantastic to me. It still looks fantastic on the big screen. What's changed?
Well, I think, restoration specialists are a bit obsessive and detail-oriented, to say the least, and I have a fantastic team working with me who, frame by frame, really examine the original material, pick the best material, and then use whatever means, whether it's traditional photochemical or digital means, to make sure both sound and image are brought back to the quality that audiences first saw. Films get incredibly beat up over time. And in fact, we did have the original negative for Great Expectations, but like a lot of original negatives, they get messed about with a lot. When they make new prints, they'll just cut in pieces of other things. So you end up with original negative that's not that great in a lot of places. And fortunately, we had another element made at the same time that was absolutely complete and consistent all the way through, which was a godsend for us.
The question of going down into a deep, fusty basement, brushing away the cobwebs, seeing a little label saying Lean Expectations, and a big kind of, a spool of film on there, like, 8 reels, 9 reels on there, and you find it. You go, this is it! Eureka, we found it.
We definitely have some eureka moments along any restoration. If you have something that's particularly important, seen or shot, and you don't have a really good condition element on it, that can be such a heartbreaker. And if you do open a can, you find a good portrait of that, then you know you've got an original element. Because you can do some digital restoration, but to find something that's really in good condition from the original is fantastic.
So tell me how it works. Because I recently took some old photographs of my brother who's getting married, some photos from the 70s when he was like 3. I scanned them in and photoshopped them up. The kind of color restoration, yeah. They called it in Snappy Snaps. Is that what you do?
Well, we use digital technology, certainly, for different reasons. For audio restoration, it's almost ubiquitous now. Everyone uses it. It's such a straightforward process. And just take out pops and clicks and bad, you know, make it smooth. And also make it, you know, available for modern sound systems is another critical issue. But we still use tools in sort of traditional photochemical printers, processors, you know, a basic film lab. We have a black and white film lab at the archive. And, you know, there's lots of people who've been working for years on black and white films and have a great, fantastic eye for actually grading. You know, when Guy Green won the award, there were 2 Academy Awards, one for black and white cinematography and one for color cinematography. You know, that when color film became so just everywhere, that went away. But black and white has a particular, you know, kind of speciality that's required. And we have fantastic people that know that way of getting that look just right.
Now, the plan is, I gather, to restore all of David Lean's output. Every single one of his films should be kind of put back on the mantelpiece for a new generation.
Yeah, I mean, some have been done. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia has famously been done several times, you know. So our cooperation with Granada means that we've been working on those films for the time being. But 2008 is David Lean's centenary, and look out for lots of different David Lean series and events so that we can really put all of David Lean's back in the public. Right? He deserves it.
Give us a taste of what's in the pipeline.
Well, we're working right now on a fantastic Technicolor film that he did, the first Technicolor film he did called The Happy Breed, which is just a wonderful story. That's coming up. Blythe Spirit we're working on as well. Brief Encounter. So just a few little tidbits.
Is there a particular scene in this Great Expectations print that's out this week? Is there a particular scene in there that needed, you know, particular work? There was there are so many fantastic scenes in there because it's taken from Dickens, and each scene is like another new chapter turn, a page turner, or serialization, as Dickens used to do it. Is there a particular one that stands out for you that required most work?
Well, I think, you know, in the very opening sequences, the graveyard sequences, you know, that sort of foggy, dark, that was a lot of work to actually get the look that Green and Lean were really trying for. And so it's a process of just testing. And the fog can actually introduce different kind of contrast and difficulty. But we're really proud of, I think we got it. I think we nailed it. And we're really pleased with that.
That was Andrea Callas, head of preservation at the British Film Institute. I'm sure if Dickens were writing today, even he might have struggled to come up with a character as monstrous as Barbara Covert. She's the old schoolmaid at the centre of Notes on a Scandal, adapted from Zoe Heller's novel by Patrick Marber and directed for the screen by Richard Eyre. We heard from Kate Blanchett last week on Film Weekly, and she plays Sheba Hart, the bourgeois bohemian art teacher at a North London comprehensive who embarks on a headstrong affair with a 15-year-old pupil, despite a seemingly happy home life with 2 kids and an older, kind husband in Bill Nighy. Barbara is played by Dame Judi Dench in quite the most riveting role of her career. It's earned her an Oscar nomination alongside Blanchett and Marber, and will hook any viewer as she and Blanchett trade insults and affection like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
Hard to read, the wispy novice. Is she a sphinx or simply stupid?
All right, off you go, please.
Artfully dishevelled today. The tweedy tramp coat is an abhorrence. It seems to say, I'm just like you. But clearly she's not.
This is a richly involving film that grows increasingly melodramatic and fruity. Eyre really lets his actresses off the leash, and it's a pleasure to watch the sparks fly while Nighy does the brilliant understatement. If there are a few jarring scenes, they come at the school when Blanchett and the boy seem so unbelievable, a coupling that is easier to imagine on the page than it is to comprehend on screen. But shot by veteran British cinematographer Chris Menges, the film has a blend of gritty London realism and a stifling closeness to it. Dench, at the age of 72, seems to be enjoying herself so completely. It reminded me of the gusto with which Anthony Hopkins, once Anthony to Judy's Cleopatra at the National Theatre, threw himself into the panto villainry of Hannibal Lecter. She practically chews up the set and the script here, and among her many preciously withering lines is the gem, "My father supported Charlton Athletic all his life, never seemed to give him any pleasure. They're as good as relegated already." In Gridiron Gang, the former wrestler plays a muscular yet thoughtful prison worker at a juvenile detention centre in California, where gang members and murderous teenagers from Compton are, as Rock puts it himself, like sheep, fattened up to be put back on the streets and slaughtered. When one former inmate is gunned down in a drive-by on his first day back in the hood, Mr. Rock thinks it's time to start up a football team so that these hoodlums can learn discipline, teamwork, and how to let their aggression out. So in a succession of motivational speeches that mostly end in "Bring it in!", he forms the Mustangs and throws down the Mustang Challenge and takes his bunch of no-hopers all the way to the playoffs. Yay, Rock! Except that this film lasts 2 hours and is full of so many clichés and grating speeches that you want to bang your head on a helmet. Coach Rock even nips off after training to tell his dying mother in hospital about his new project and his tough day on the gridiron. There she is on a respirator being all kind and sweet and on death's door, and I half expected him to bawl at her, "Come on, you can beat this cancer, do it my way, put me on my ass, bring it in!" She promptly dies. The closing credits reveal this film was actually based on a true story, and documentary footage of the real coach at work is shown, where he's giving his speeches to the inmates. Unbelievably, they're exactly the same as the Rock's speeches, except the real guy has a porn star moustache. And this week's Film Weekly competition boasts a fantastic Hannibal prize. This is a lip-smacking, hardback edition of Hannibal Rising, the latest novel in the series, signed by its author, Thomas Harris. Now, he doesn't do this very often, so this is a real rarity. We've also got a copy of Brian Cox in the original Manhunter. It's re-released in DVD to go with the new film, Hannibal Rising. So, how's about that? Get your lips around that, get your tongue going, and answer this question. Silence of the Lambs achieved a rare feat at the Oscars in 1991. What was that feat, and with which two other films does it share that distinction? Send your answers on an email to podcasts@observer.co.uk, and please don't forget to include your address, otherwise we do not know where to send the fabulous prize of a signed Thomas Harris edition of Hannibal Rising and a DVD of Brian Cox as that original Hannibal Lecter. Last week's competition boasted the fantastic prize of Directed by Douglas Sirk, a box set of 7 of the master's wonderful films, including Imitation of Life and All That Heaven Allows. I asked you which actress starred in 2 recent films clearly influenced by the work of Douglas Sirk. Name the films, the directors, and the actress. We had entries from everywhere, from New York, from Ireland, from London, from Brighton. But the one that closely matched my thoughts was from Tallahassee in Florida, USA. Hello, Tallahassee. I've always wanted to say that. Edith Darling is the winner. Hello, says Edith. Julianne Moore has starred in 2 recent films closely influenced by the work of Douglas Sirk. In 2002, she starred in Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, a glorious tearjerker honouring Sirk in every frame. And in 2005, she starred in Jane Anderson's The Prize Winner of Defiance, Ohio. Well done, Edith, darling. Douglas Sirk box set is on its way with wings to Florida, where I'm sure the colours are as bright as a Douglas Sirk movie themselves. Thanks, Edith, darling. Every week on Film Weekly, we've been asking you to ring our special rant line with your reactions to films you've just seen, old or new, good or bad. We just want your opinions. And this week's opinions sound a little bit like this.
Hello, my name's Simon from Bournemouth, and I'm calling up about the film Black Book, which I went to see the other night. It had the potential to be a great film, I thought, because it's a fascinating subject matter about the resistance in the Second World War. But it would have been a great film had it been directed by someone else, because in Paul Verhoeven's hands it ended up being essentially some Hollywood schmaltz. There was a lot of tittering at inappropriate moments when I was watching it, although I did find it titillating at times as well. It was an enjoyable film, but I'm not sure it was worth the 2 hours plus of viewing which I had to invest in watching it, so thumbs down from me.
Hello, this is Sam from North London. I'm calling up about The Last King of Scotland. I thought it was a visually arresting film. It was just amazing. He totally understood a naive Scotsman's journey into Africa, and it was very vibrant and lovely. The ensemble cast, led by McAvoy and Whittaker, was just amazing, really superb acting. Unfortunately, I sort of felt like the narrative was very light and probably didn't deserve such amazing performances.
Hi, this is Noah from Manchester, and I've just been to see Pan's Labyrinth, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It's a very strange juxtaposition of two settings, this magical gothic underworld and a kind of brutal, hyper-violent, stylized setting in the Spanish Civil War. Very claustrophobic and dark, and it's got fantastic performances from Vanna Baquero, who plays the 11-year-old girl Ophelia, and also Maribel Verdú, who plays the servant girl Mercedes, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
That's what Film Weekly listeners have been saying on The Rant Line. Join them on 020 7713 4738. That's 020 7713 4738. Put that number in your phones now. As soon as you see a film that gets you in a critical lather, give us a ring and be on The Rant Line. Your voice could be heard on Film Weekly. And other voices on Film Weekly next week will include Anna Friel as a footballer's wife in Goal 2. We look forward to the BAFTAs. We look at the 14 films heading our way like a tidal wave of cinema, and we explored the dark side of jazz at the movies with My Name is Albert Ayler. I've been Jason Solomons. Thank you for listening to Film Weekly. The show has been produced by Paul Noble. We wish you happy viewing. Until next week.